Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to the show. On KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a provocative debate on end-of-life care in the UK and new rules for developers on how to manage groundwater. But first, welcome to Thanksgiving week. It's a week of big decisions. What to eat, when to eat it, how many pies is too many pies? For some of us, the answers to those questions are, in order, everything, constantly, and there's no such thing. Which, of course, means that once the big meal is over, it's hard to imagine doing much beyond putting on your soft pants and watching TV. And as you swipe through your various streaming services, one of the options you may find yourself considering is the recent Netflix series, Wyatt Earp and the Cowboy War, a documentary narrated by Ed Harris.
Forget everything you know about Wild West history. The gunfight at the OK Corral. It wasn't the end of the story. It was just the beginning.
Wyatt Earp and the Cowboy War explores a legendary gunfight in Tombstone, Arizona. In October of 1881, three brothers, Virgil, Morgan, and Wyatt Earp, opened fire on a band of outlaws, killing three of them in the middle of the street in broad daylight. The whole thing lasted less than a minute, but in the 143 years since it happened, the shootout has inspired dozens of books, films, and TV shows. And the constant telling and retelling of the story has transformed this brief, bloody brawl into one of the archetypal scenes of the Old West. So much so that Tombstone, a city of less than 2,000 residents, gets about 500,000 tourists every year. Justin St. Germain grew up in Tombstone. He later wrote a book about the tiny town's enormous impact on his life. And earlier this year, when he sat down to watch Wyatt Earp and the Cowboy War, he thought, really? We're doing this again?
It just seems like this kind of law of eternal return, where it's like every 20 years or... I was living in Tombstone in the 90s when both the movie Tombstone and the movie Wyatt Earp came out within, I think, a year of each other. And so in some ways that seemed to be like the last big moment Tombstone had. And then obviously, you know, in the 50s or in the 30s with all the original pulpy Western movies, it was prominent then too. So it just seems like every now and then we have to go back to the story of Wyatt Earp.
Yeah. So why do you think this story prompts this eternal return? Like, what are the things in the American consciousness that it kicks up that we have a hard time with?
In the context of this show, it seems like there's a real desire to see a very simplistic version of history where everything gets solved by one tough guy with a gun, you know?
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how you perceived the story as a kid? You know, I'm imagining there were waves of tourists that would come into Tombstone, and you know, this was just the place where you lived. What was that like?
To be totally honest with you, I think for me and for my friends, the people who grew up there, we kind of thought it was a joke. Mm-hmm. We just didn't take it very seriously, didn't know much about it. Growing up, one of my best friends lived, he lived right across the street from the OK Corral.
Uh-huh.
And so we'd sit in his bedroom, you know, playing video games, whatever. And in the OK Corral, at least there used to be, I think it's still there, there's, you know, statues where the gunfighters were, and then there's kind of a button where you just press the button and it narrates out loud the story of the gunfight.
Yeah.
And so we would just hear the story of the gunfight over and over and over again. And I think that's kind of the best metaphor I have for what it was like to grow up in Tombstone.
Uh-huh.
It's like, it's just always happening. The gunfight's always happening in the background.
What about when the movie Tombstone and the Wyatt Earp movie came out? You know, those are obviously other well-known versions of this story. Did you have any relationship with those beyond just this idea of the story is kind of a joke?
Yeah, that was when Tombstone especially. I still love that movie. I watch that movie all the time. And I kind of have become slightly obsessed with Val Kilmer because of that movie. I saw Val Kilmer in Tombstone recently when he came back for a few years ago, he came back for Val Kilmer Days. And
wow.
Yeah.
So what was it that you connected with about Val Kilmer?
I just thought he was so good as Doc Holliday. And I think he was so good in that movie that it kind of made me care about the story. Hmm. One of the strange things about, like I said, it's always in the background. I didn't even really know much of the Wyatt Earp story until that movie came out. Mm-hmm. I think there's just something about seeing your town on the big screen. And even if it's not your town, you know, a Hollywood version of your town, and just having this sense like, oh, maybe Tombstone was important.
Well, if we can talk about your memoir,
sure.
You also have a very tragic association with it as a place, right?
I do, yeah. So, you know, my book is about my mother's murder, which happened outside of Tombstone, but was very heavily tied up in Tombstone. We had been living in Tombstone. She had been living in Tombstone for, I think, 13 years at the time. Mm-hmm. Her murderer was a police officer in Tombstone. And as you might imagine, police officers in Tombstone then, and I'm guessing now, had a way of kind of modeling themselves, you know, in the mold of the Wyatt Earp, mm-hmm. you know, mustaches, and walked around like they were, you know, kings of the town. And so I was trying to take a look at, like, how does growing up in a town whose hero is celebrated for winning a gunfight, how does that kind of like filter into everybody's psychology?
Right.
And you know, how does like worshiping an act of violence, the gunfight at the OK Corral, what does that do to a town?
Well, it makes me think of one of the most harrowing sequences in your book. Your mom was murdered, if I'm not mistaken, 8 days after the attacks on September 11th.
Correct, yeah.
And you go to a bar and you're sitting there processing the loss of your mom, and you look up on the screen and there's George W. Bush. Can you tell me a little bit about what George W. Bush was saying in that moment?
As I recall, he was essentially talking about Osama bin Laden. You know, in a lot of ways, it kind of maps pretty similarly to this myth of the OK Corral, that it was about, we were going to get righteous justice. Vengeance was coming.
Yeah. I was so moved by that passage because, to me, it's such an interesting illustration of, you know, here you've just had this horrific illustration in your life of the dangers of believing too much in this mythology of, you know, the guy with the gun who can solve all the problems. And there on national television is the President of the United States invoking the value of that really misguided idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've met with a lot of other people who have been through similar experiences to mine. You know, one of the tough things about writing about murder is that it's actually not as novel as people think it is, and especially in America. There's mm-hmm. a lot of people who've had similar experiences, and frankly, maybe worse experiences in many ways. But one of the things you kind of realize is that in real life, vengeance for that kind of thing, if your loved one gets murdered, it doesn't really exist. Mm-hmm. And if it does, it doesn't do anybody any good.
Yeah. But that idea that vengeance is gonna solve something and right all the wrongs, that seems to be a big part of what really sticks to the ribs about this Wyatt Earp story.
It absolutely does. I think, you know, one of the most compelling parts of the story all the time is in any format it's told in, is the vendetta ride, right? Where he's just going around murdering people as revenge for Virgil getting shot and his other brother Morgan getting killed.
Yeah. Could you say, from your own perspective, what was healing for you?
I think in some ways I'm a little bit conflicted and even maybe a little bit suspicious about the idea of healing all the way or of closure. I think there's a lot of pressure put on people who have survived violence in whatever way to achieve closure. And I think that can be kind of counterproductive. But for me, I also do think that there are things that help, you know. And I think one of the things that helped, oddly enough, was kind of writing the book. You know, I think writing, obviously, I think you want to accomplish more than just therapy. I wasn't just doing it for me. I was doing it for a reader. But I did find out that once I was done with it, I could kind of put that part of my life in a more appropriate place in the past and like still acknowledge it as a part of history, but not obsess about it quite as much as I had been until then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is such a spiritual idea that we're suddenly talking about here, this idea that maybe what's important about these stories is not that there is some definitive version of them that is ultimately going to get it right, but that by telling it and retelling it and finding different ways into it, we understand a little bit more of it every time.
Yeah, I think that might be true. And I sort of wish that the Wyatt Earp story could kind of come be retold in a way more often where it's illustrating really the idea that, I mean, I think the gunfight at the OK Corral was not some great achievement. It was a great tragedy. You know, it's a lot of people dying for no real reason.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we need to celebrate that quite as much as it seems like maybe we do.
Well, Justin St. Germain is the author of Son of a Gun, his memoir about the murder of his mother. Justin, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks a lot, Sam. Great talking to you.
New rules to allow developers to build in areas that don't have the necessary 100-year assured water supply have won the approval of a key panel. The plan, known as Alternative Path to Designation of a 100-Year Assured Water Supply, calls for developers to find other sources of water to supplemental groundwater supplies and to eventually wean themselves off groundwater. This would apply in areas that do not have the needed century's worth of groundwater, like Buckeye and Queen Creek. The approval, late last week, by the Governor's Regulatory Review Council came over the objection of home builders and others who argue the new rules are unfair. But the head of the Arizona Department of Water Resources defends them, saying they'll help both builders and the state's groundwater supplies. ADWR Director Tom Buschatsky talked about this earlier with my co-host Mark Brody. They spoke before the council's approval, and they started with why Buschatsky thinks this is the right plan.
So designations of assured water supply are kind of the gold standard of the program because a designated provider has an obligation to replenish mined groundwater for all of the uses that it supplies, not just home building. Under the certificate of assured water supply, it's just the home building uses that have to have the mined groundwater replaced. And so in that situation, you could have industries or other users pumping groundwater away. And we want to try to incentivize entities to achieve designations of assured water supply. One of the challenges there is these providers that are not yet designated have uses historically that have not had replenishment requirements, and then they're going to take that on. So they're going to end up with a pretty big kind of overnight replenishment requirement, which is a big challenge for them.
Yeah. Do you have a sense, or do you have like an ideal situation in mind for where developers or others who would have to find other sources of water would find those sources of water?
So there are some sources of water that are available within our state. There's a groundwater basin called Harquahala, west of the Phoenix area. In the 1990s, the state legislature, by law, made that water available to kind of the Phoenix, Tucson metro areas and the corridors in between. So folks can go out there and move that water from that area to this area. That's one example. Another, with a more renewable supply, is on the Colorado River. The Colorado River Indian tribes were recently granted authority to lease or market their water. So that's another possibility. One that's a little bit less popular and carries some more debate is, again, moving water from farmland along the Colorado River. But farmers along the river are concerned about giving up their water for the cities and how that all plays into the balance between the policy choices of how our water is used for agriculture, industry, or municipal use.
Yeah. Is it a safe assessment of your thinking that should these rules go into effect, that there are enough places where developers and builders could get water to make up for the groundwater that they can't use to allow the kind of building that they want to do to go forward?
So the answer is yes.
How optimistic are you that this plan will be able to go forward? And I know that it's been talked about that this might be subject of a lawsuit, whether or not the governor and ADWR have the legal authority to actually do this. Like, how optimistic are you it would take effect?
I'm extremely optimistic. As you can imagine, before we even proposed this rule, we had lots of internal discussions with our staff and in this particular case with my legal counsel. And we have a strong legal opinion from my legal counsel that this is legal. I know that there are several water providers, the Arizona Water Company, which has service in both Maricopa County and Pinal County, but especially Pinal County, EPCOR Water Company, same thing. The town of Queen Creek all have issued, registered their support with the Regulatory Review Council for this new rule.
There are, of course, though, people who don't love it. We heard from the head of the Home Builders of Central Arizona, who basically says it's too expensive. Homes are more efficient than industrial or manufacturing type uses, so maybe there should be some differentiation there. I'm curious what you make of concerns like that, of criticism like that.
So the law requires replenishment for mine groundwater use for home building. The program, again, which is designed to incentivize designated providers, then expands that requirement to all of the uses of the designated provider. So from a water management policy standpoint, it's a better outcome. In terms of concerns raised by the home builders about the expense, how much of the price of a home is tied up into the water supply for that home, I think varies, but it's a very small percentage, probably single digits, in terms of the total cost of the home. I'm not a home builder. That's not my business, obviously.
Sure.
But in the alternative, given the conditions of our groundwater aquifers in Pinal and Maricopa County, we cannot continue to build on groundwater. This new rule allows some groundwater to be used to give a phase-in period for those renewable supplies to be accessed and implemented. But when you look out over a 100-year time frame, the net effect on the groundwater aquifers is strongly positive. So we are benefiting over the 100 years of the groundwater aquifer. We're giving some lead time in this program, and it's a good balancing. And I think it's a really good policy because it does, at the end of the day, create the consumer protection for the homes and create an additional benefit to the groundwater aquifers that does not exist today.
Let me ask you about something else that you're very heavily involved in. That is negotiations over the Colorado River, another source of water that is not as strong as maybe we would like it or it has been in the past. And you kind of floated recently the idea of maybe the states not being able to come to an agreement, the upper basin and the lower basin states, and maybe this having to go to the courts.
So first, the big goal of the state of Arizona and what we want is a collaborative outcome among the seven states. There's a pretty big gap, or I use the word chasm, to describe where we are between each other. And that gap really is that Arizona, California, and Nevada have put on the table large reductions in their water use as a starting point. And then if additional reductions are needed, we want to share with the four upper basin states, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah, those additional reductions. And essentially at this point in time, those four states have not offered any volumes of reductions with any certainty. They've talked a little bit about maybe voluntary programs, but unfortunately, if those voluntary programs don't come to fruition, we in Arizona could still be on the hook for coming up with those volumes. So we're looking for a more equitable outcome. And the proposal put forth by the three states, California, Arizona, and Nevada, we didn't start the negotiation from one end of the spectrum so we can negotiate towards the middle. We already started in the middle by stepping up and taking and proposing to take the first cuts. There's certainly room to negotiate further for us, but we need to see participation by those four states.
As a negotiating strategy, I guess, like, do you think that by saying what you said, that it will lead to a better deal for the three lower basin states? I mean, the upper basin states, perhaps not surprisingly, aren't real thrilled with what you had to say.
So when we talk with each other, and we have for many, many months, we all say to each other, we don't want litigation. That is not an outcome. I think actions speak louder than words sometimes. We have not seen anything in terms of action that would make you believe that that's an outcome that they really want. So obviously they are unhappy that I went down this path. Hopefully that will move the needle. But I think as a general proposition in these really difficult negotiations, there needs to be a view that you have risk. If you do not think you have risk to an outcome worse than what you might negotiate, you're not going to negotiate. And again, we're trying to show that there is risk, despite maybe the differences in legal opinion about what that risk might be or how big that risk might be.
So understanding that crystal balls are often cloudy, you've been doing this for a long time now. What's your gut feeling about how these negotiations are going to end up?
So gut feeling is we're going to probably continue to see and move towards brinkmanship. And at the end of the day, when deadlines start coming up and decisions absolutely have to be made, we're going to end up with a collaborative deal.
All right. That is Tom Buschotsky, director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources. Tom, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
And thanks for inviting me. This is a really important topic to me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, how one local high school student's family helped him feel more comfortable in his own skin. But first, a new report from Arizona's Medicaid program, looking at hospital profitability and the levels of uncompensated care, finds hospitals' operating margins overall are getting healthier. But at the same time, some facilities have seen big increases in the number of patients who can't pay for their treatment. Anne-Marie Alamedine is president and CEO of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association. She spoke more about the report with my co-host, Mark Brody, and they started with her main takeaways from the report.
So I think the top line is that hospitals across Arizona have a net operating margin of about 6%. And I think this is important. I think we're looking for a minimum of between 4 and 6% net operating margin. That's to ensure that hospitals can really take those profits and reinvest in their increased facilities, improved technology, you know, to retain workforce. So there's just and to have cash on hand to make sure that they can weather, you know, whatever's coming ahead.
So this would be then at the sort of the top of where you would ideally like hospitals to be. Is that different than where you have been over the past few years, where hospitals have been?
Absolutely. You know, throughout COVID, with the suspension of elective surgeries, there's just a significant impact on hospital operations, being able to recruit and retain workforce. We just saw financials really plummet across the country, really, not just in Arizona. And, you know, Congress acted. There was a lot of supplemental funds that flowed to make sure that hospitals were able to stay fully operational to meet the incredible demand that was put upon both hospitals and our healthcare workforce, taking care of patients who needed that care.
Is that supplemental funding mostly responsible for where hospitals are now? Are there other factors that have led them to maybe be a little more financially healthy?
So I think all the supplemental sort of COVID dollars have gone away. And so this is really kind of standard operating work right now. I think hospitals have stabilized. I think workforce, although there is still a workforce shortage, We're not paying quite as much as we were for the temporary, traveling nurses. I think a lot of that has stabilized. But when you look at the margins, and it's at an average of 6%, there are pockets that are much lower. You know, long-term acute care hospitals, they have negative operating margins of 11%. Hmm. Behavioral health hospitals, they have seen an increase in uncompensated care. That means patients who are coming to behavioral health hospitals who do not have health insurance. So a significant increase of 50% for uncompensated care. So although that's the average, there are different pockets. And I think particularly when you look at Arizona's healthcare system, the behavioral health system is really fragile right now.
Do you find that there are differences between rural and urban hospitals as well? I know in the past, you and I have spoken mm-hmm. about sort of the precarious financial state of rural hospitals. Are they still in that position, or are they starting to come back up to where you'd like them to be?
You know, the average was, I think, 5% for rural hospitals versus acute care hospitals, which was 6%. So they have so many unique challenges that are unique to rural markets. But they are on the positive side right now, which is really good.
So you mentioned the uncompensated care in the behavioral health facilities up 50%. That's at the same time that overall uncompensated care was down by about 10%. Is it surprising to you? And I guess maybe what does it mean for those facilities that the level of uncompensated care, the number of patients who are coming in who can't pay, is going up by that much?
Yeah, it puts a tremendous strain. Well, I mean, I think first we have to take a patient-centered approach to it. You know, what does it mean? We should have healthcare insurance should be affordable to people, because it's really important that people have insurance so they can access the care when they need it at mm-hmm. the appropriate time. But then it puts that pressure on behavioral health hospitals when you do have these patients who don't have a payer source, and where that hospital is just absorbing the cost of that care. So it is concerning. I was really surprised to see that it was so high at 50%. And we need to really kind of unpack that and understand what's really happening in the state.
You mentioned insurance, and obviously mm-hmm. we are in the open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act. What are your members saying about the kind of, not so much the number of patients coming in with insurance, but maybe the kind of insurance that they are coming in with, and the kinds of procedures and provider visits that is covering, and what that all means for hospitals' ability to get reimbursed for what they're doing and maintain their sustainability?
You know, I think we've seen great improvement since the Affordable Care Act in terms of more people using the exchange and really making sure that our uncompensated care numbers were lower. I think we've made great strides, and we just need to continue that. And I think as we look at a new presidential administration, you know, what are President Trump's priorities going to be? Is there going to be a attempted rollback of some of the Affordable Care Act provisions on, you know, pre-existing conditions? Or, I mean, it could be a whole host of things. So I think that's what we're looking ahead at in terms of, you know, how do we best develop our story and the current situation in terms of what's at stake.
What kinds of conversations are you having with your members, and maybe them within themselves, and, you know, with your colleagues and counterparts across the country about what might be coming down the pike come January when the new administration takes shape, and maybe trying to read some of the tea leaves to get ready for what some of those changes might be?
Yeah. Well, I think as we saw with the first Trump administration, you know, there was a kind of a scrutiny of healthcare payments around supplemental payments that the federal government pays to various states through the Medicaid program. And if you look at Arizona, you know, one of our really important programs is a Healthy 2 payment program. And really, if that supplemental payment went away, that would have a devastating impact on the whole healthcare financing system in Arizona. Really, we would be operating in the red. So we have to make sure that hospitals are telling their story, you know, communicating to patients and their community, and communicating to policymakers in terms of what's at stake.
So you alluded to the ongoing shortage of providers. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that's gotten any better for your members. Like, where are we in terms of having enough physicians and nurses and techs and all the people who make hospitals work?
Yeah. Arizona still is in a significant healthcare worker shortage. We've been making some inroads, I think, with some legislation that the Arizona legislature passed a couple of years ago in terms of expanding nursing education and training and retention. But there's more work to be done. You know, ultimately, you know, we need more GME slots for Arizona.
Graduate medical education.
You know, you can have a lot of medical schools, and it's wonderful that we have so many medical schools here. But then the next step after that is a residency program. And so if our Arizona medical school students are graduating and then going across the country to other states with more residency slots, they tend not to come back to Arizona. They stay where they've done their residency. So there's more work that we have to do, particularly on the physician side. But a lot of work has been done on the nursing side. The Arizona Hospital Healthcare Association has a nurse retention program that really helps with mentorship and preceptorship and development of new nurses who are at hospitals to really bridge that gap between nursing education and then being an actual nurse on a floor to make sure that new nurses feel supported and guided and that they spend their career in healthcare.
All right. That is Anne-Marie Alameddine, President and CEO of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association. Anne-Marie, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. As America enters a week where politics tend to slow down a little bit, some high-stakes debates are unfolding across the rest of the world. Joining me now via Skype to preview some significant international storylines is the BBC's Jonathan Frewen. Jonathan, let's begin in South Korea, where you're keeping an eye on talks regarding a plastic waste treaty. What's the background here?
Well, these talks are known as INC5, short for Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee, and they will last for a week, rounding off 2 years of discussions. Let's look first at the scale of the problem. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development estimates that in 2019, the world produced around 460 million tons of plastic, which is a figure that has doubled since the year 2000. Plastic production is further expected to triple by 2060, but the discussions have faced quite substantial disagreements on how to proceed.
So what are these main points of disagreement?
Well, the main fault line centers around how to tackle the problem. There's a group of countries known as the High Ambition Coalition, which includes many African, Asian, and European nations. And this group wants to examine the entire life cycle of plastics. Now, that could mean limiting production, redesigning products for greater reuse and recycling, and tackling waste. Opposed to that group are countries mainly significant oil producers, such as Saudi Arabia and Russia, who want to focus on plastic waste alone. These divisions have led to deadlock in four previous rounds of talks and led to a lengthy draft treaty running to more than 70 pages. Now, the diplomat chairing these talks has produced an alternative document which aims to focus on areas of agreement, including the need to promote plastics reusability. And that comes in at a much more manageable 17 pages. But environmental campaigners argue that it leaves the thorniest issues largely unaddressed. So it's quite a lot for the negotiators in South Korea to get stuck into this week. And there are already signs that some countries will seek to kick the can down the road, so to speak, and delay any deal until the new year.
So some high-stakes conversations there. Let's jump continents now, Jonathan. On Friday, voters in the Republic of Ireland go to the polls. How has this election come about?
Well, back in 2020, the election brought about a striking result, ushering in a coalition government led by two parties who put aside almost a century of rivalry. Fianna Gael is led by Simon Harris, who is the outgoing prime minister, known as the Taoiseach. Fianna Fáil is headed by Micheál Martin, who was also Taoiseach earlier in the term. They're both broadly parties of the political centre. Sinn Féin, led by Mary Lou MacDonald, has been the main opposition party in Dublin. It's left-wing, and it's also the largest political force in Northern Ireland, which of course remains part of the United Kingdom. Now, earlier this month, Simon Harris decided to call a snap election, seeking to capitalise on a recent period of good polling for his party. There are a number of key issues that have been capturing attention in the election. First up, the high cost of renting or buying a home is a huge topic. And for the first time, immigration has become a mainstream issue. Candidates are standing for 174 seats in the parliament, that's the Dáil, and 88 seats result in an overall majority. Last time around, it took Fianna Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Green Party about 3 months to form a government, and it's certain that there will be coalition negotiations this time around, and a range of smaller parties may well be involved.
So a lot of moving parts there. You mentioned the polls. What do the latest round of opinion polls say about how this is all going to shake out?
Well, as I mentioned, Simon Harris's Fine Gael has had a boost to his poll ratings. He's been dubbed the TikTok Taoiseach because of his social media savvy. Most observers seem to think that a repeat of the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil coalition is the most likely outcome.
So staying in this region, Jonathan, there's also a debate and vote in the UK Parliament this Friday on a very intriguing piece of legislation. This would be a bill that would legalize assisted dying in England and Wales. Fill us in on this.
Well, yeah, at the moment, laws throughout the UK prevent people from asking for medical help to die. The question of whether assisted dying should be legalised was last examined by Parliament back in 2015, when it was voted down overwhelmingly by 330 votes against to 118 in favour. The broadcaster and high-profile campaigner Esther Ranson put the issue back on the political agenda when she revealed that she had terminal lung cancer and wanted the option of ending her life at a time of her own choosing. Prime Minister Keir Starmer says that before the election that he won in July, he'd promised Esther Ranson a debate and free vote on the issue, meaning party members would not be instructed which way to vote. This Friday's debate is the outcome of that. Now, this bill is not being proposed by government. Instead, it's what's known of as a private members' bill and is being spearheaded by the Labour MP Kim Leadbeater. Private members' bills rarely pass, but some fairly significant legislative changes have come about through them, including the abolition of the death penalty and the legalization of abortion.
So what's in this bill and what's the likely outcome?
Well, it says anyone who wants to end their life must be over 18 and registered with a general practitioner for 12 months. They must have the mental capacity to make the choice and be deemed to have expressed a clear wish to die. They must be expected to die within 6 months and satisfy two doctors that they're eligible. A High Court judge must also give approval, and the person seeking to end their life must be able to take the substance being used to kill them by their own hand. Many members of Parliament have not announced their position on the bill. Some are supportive and some have said they will not support it. They include the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who argues that the palliative care system in the country is not good enough to support assisted dying. That said, the makeup of the House of Commons is very different from how it was last time this issue was debated in 2015. So it's very difficult to predict how the vote will go at the end of this week. And this is just the first stage in a fairly lengthy parliamentary process if MPs do vote in favour of the legislation on Friday. But there is broad support in the country for a change in the law. Polling suggests around five times as many people support assisted dying as are opposed to it.
Wow. Well, lots of high stakes, very thorny issues being debated this week all over the world. The BBC's Jonathan Frewen keeping us up to speed as always. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman. When you think of Thanksgiving, you probably think about one big juicy thing first: a turkey sitting in the middle of the table. But Damon Brash is here to tell you, you don't need it. Brash is the chef and owner of Green New American Vegetarian, which has two locations in Tempe and Phoenix. And he's become well known in town for his vegan Thanksgiving, which he has dubbed Thanks Living. The show's Lauren Gilger got the chance to cook some vegan Thanksgiving fare with him in his restaurant kitchen.
We are cooking up some Thanksgiving food. This time of year, we cook a lot of it at the restaurant. And today I'm going to prepare a stuffed squash dish for you that is really easy to make, and we'll walk you through all the steps.
Okay, let's get started.
Do you want to walk to the kitchen?
Let's go, yeah, okay. I'll follow you.
Okay, so here we have some stuffing. It's really, really basic. It's a nice bread stuffing. Bread is the base, crunchy bread. It's got some roasted mushrooms in there. It's got some roasted kale in there. It's got some red peppers. Everything in here is really, really accessible. You just kind of saute it in a little bit of butter, add your stuffing in, add a little bit of stock. Obviously, everything we do here is plant-based, so the stock that we use is usually a mushroom stock, or there are some pretty great faux chicken stocks out on the market these days, too. But you can always make your own. There's so many great recipes online. Yeah. And then you just cook that up, and you have something pretty delicious.
It smells really good.
So we'll fire this up. And this is going to be the base for our dish. This is my favorite part of this meal, is it's a tomato sauce base, but it kind of, I'm Italian, so like, you know, some Italians call tomato sauce gravy. So we're not doing a traditional Thanksgiving gravy for this, but we're doing a red sauce gravy. And this will be the base. And the tomatoes just meld so well with the squash. It really just brings everything together, makes everything super unctuous and very flavorful.
I would have never thought of a tomato sauce base in a stuffing or in a squash. So you're stirring this up here.
Yeah, we're letting this go. In here, we have a little bit of organic tomato. We have some organic tamari. Again, we have a little bit of mushroom seasoning, a little garlic, a little white wine. And we just puree it down into like a nice smooth sauce. Over here, we've got two different kinds of squash. Do you have a preference? Do you like a spaghetti squash or an acorn squash?
I love acorn squash.
Me too. So the squash is kind of interesting. I grew up eating squash and not really liking it very much. I don't want to diss anybody that was cooking in my house, but it takes a certain touch to make squash delicious. And I always start at least a couple of hours beforehand. It's so easy. Rub it with a little olive oil, salt, and pepper. If you like it a little sweet, a little maple syrup, throw it in a 400 oven for about an hour or so. And then turn off the oven, cover it, and just leave it for another hour. And just let it steep in those juices, and it'll come into this beautiful, very soft, very unctuous, delicious sauce. So.
That's a great tip. I love it. Okay. So we're frying up the squash here.
Yeah, we kind of have our plancha here. You could use a cast iron skillet at home. Get it nice and hot. Put a little bit of olive oil in there and just drop it down in there and caramelize the edges.
Okay. All right, so we're browning them up. They're looking good.
So those are nice and cooked. So we're going to grab our plate. And you said you like acorn, so we'll start with that.
So the tomato sauce is going on the plate.
So we're going to put the tomato sauce down on the plate. And then we're just going to take a little bit of stuffing and just carefully stuff it in there.
Beautiful.
All right.
So, I mean, you're sort of an evangelist when it comes to not just vegetarian and vegan cuisine, but the fact that it can taste really good, right?
Oh, yeah, that's the biggest part. We've been lucky enough to be here for a really long time. A lot of people love our restaurant, and people always ask me, we don't know what you do to make it so delicious. Like, we don't sacrifice anything by coming to eat here. And I always say we just season things correctly. We make it taste good. It's not a big secret. A little bit of salt, a little bit of fat, and everything is going to taste delicious. And who doesn't love a stuffed squash or a burger from time to time?
Okay, so you put the fried onions on top. You got fresh pomegranate seeds you're going to put on top here as well?
Yeah, so you just let them kind of sprinkle and fall all around the shoestring onions here. And you have a pretty nice looking dish. I mean, anybody getting that at a Thanksgiving meal would be pretty happy.
It's right? Beautiful. It's true. So I guess, I mean, sure, you can make flavorful vegetarian cuisine. But at the same time, I think, like, when it comes to the holidays, that's a tougher sell in some ways, it must be, because so many people are used to the big, giant turkey, and, like, there's all these traditions that go with it. And it sounds like you've become very successful in convincing people otherwise, that you don't need those things here with your events over Thanksgiving.
Yeah, so on Thanksgiving, you know, plant-based folks or vegan people don't really have a big opportunity to go out to eat, or, you know, sometimes the food can be a little tricky. So we started this event about 12, 13 years ago, and it's called Thanks Living. We have it here at the restaurant. We give you reheating instructions. They come in a reheatable pan. And we make it so, so simple. And we feed like 1,000 people, and they love it.
Did it take any convincing for people when you started this event to sort of say, like, you don't need a turkey on Thanksgiving?
No, I think that there was enough of an outcry of people who really wanted to see something like that in the Valley. And it just grew and grew and grew. The first year, I think we had like 200 people, and it was a really wonderful event. And then the next year, that doubled. And then the year after that, it doubled. And so it's just been getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
The meal completed, we headed to the back of the restaurant to talk more about his approach to vegan cuisine and how to tackle it around the holidays.
So we've got these beautiful dishes that are proving your point that you can make beautiful Thanksgiving meals that are vegan, that are vegetarian. I wonder, though, I mean, tell us a little bit about how you began in this. Like, have you always been a vegetarian?
I have not. No, I grew up in Chicago. I was a meat-eating kid, pretty normal. When I was about 18, 19, a good friend of mine gave me a book called Diet for a New America, which I recommend everybody read. And it just made me realize that where our food comes from is more than, you know, you have to look at that next layer of where your food is coming from. You should always balance, I think, your diet. So we don't ever preach that you need to be vegan. Like, that's super annoying. But we do just say, like, be conscious of, you know, where your food is coming from and try to approach it from a healthful standpoint and have some balance. And I think it's better for, you know, your own personal health, and I think it's better for the environment for sure.
So you've sort of made a name for yourself with this restaurant and the work that you do as sort of like a vegan or a vegetarian chef who can make things taste super good. Like, I think your burger, right, was like on one of the lists of like the New York Times best burgers in the country, but it's a vegan burger, which is sort of crazy to people. What's your philosophy on this? Like, it doesn't have to be, you know, all salads, it seems like.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I love salads, but I don't want to eat a salad every day. Our restaurant is formulated for the meat eater, for the omnivore, somebody who really enjoys having a real burger from time to time. All that we're saying is give us a chance and you might feel better doing something good for yourself, doing something good for the environment, and not having to sacrifice the flavors that you're used to. My father-in-law is a great guy and he loves Mickey D's. And he comes into our restaurant and he orders a Big Whack, which is just like another sandwich with a similar name. And he loves it, you know, and I'm sure he would tell me the truth if it wasn't any good. But it's really a delicious alternative for sure.
And you use a lot of sort of meat replacement products, things like that, that are uncanny, I will say, from experience. When it comes to the holidays, particularly Thanksgiving, which is all about the turkey, which is all about sort of like the signature dishes, what are the biggest challenges in sort of recreating that in a plant-based way?
It can be challenging. I mean, sometimes it's so traditional with that big bird in the middle of the table. But, you know, I don't know, if you're looking for something a little bit more interesting, a little bit more healthful, a little bit better for you, there's so many interesting things happening in the culinary world, in the vegan culinary world right now. It's really, really an exciting time.
Yeah, it does seem to be changing and innovating a lot. Okay, so we have a beautiful sort of stuffing squash dish here, which covers two of the big bases, I think, of Thanksgiving. What do you do for a turkey, though?
At the restaurant, we make a seitan turkey. So seitan is a whole protein made from wheat gluten. We season it and we bread it with organic hemp seeds and panko and we fry it up. I know the fried turkey was all the rage, so that fit us perfectly. And it kind of flakes and tears just like regular turkey. And then the rest of the meal is very traditional. We have an amazing pimento corn. We have these fried Brussels sprouts with brown butter. Everything is 100% plant-based. Our stuffing is an organic cranberry walnut stuffing, similar to this one that we made today, but not totally the same. But so, so delicious.
So number one tip to somebody who's thinking about doing a vegetarian or a vegan Thanksgiving for the first time, thinking maybe I could do this, maybe I can sacrifice the turkey this year and not go that route. What do you think they should try first?
If you want to go and try and do it yourself, one, you absolutely can. Just have fun with it. Less is more. You don't need to go crazy with all the different sauces and all that kind of stuff. Mashed potatoes are delicious because they're simple. You know, and whether it's the vegan version or the traditional version, they make a vegan heavy cream, they make vegan butter, you know, use a good quality potato and follow the instructions on how to do it. And everything can be switched out. Just don't be nervous to do it. You can do it.
Thank you so much, David, for having me out. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Your holiday lights have likely been on for months, but today really is just the first day of Thanksgiving week. In honor, we've asked students of Cary Deal at Alhambra High School in West Phoenix to tell us what they're grateful for. Here's 11th grader Omar Bauer.
I am thankful for my lovely family, my sister, my mom, and my dad. My family helps me get a good education and good health care. They supported me through my basketball games, even though I didn't play much. They were on the stands cheering me. When I stepped on the court during third quarter, I saw my parents smiling at me. I knew when I saw those smiles, they were happy for me and proud that I'm playing my favorite sport. They also supported me through my education. The reason why I'm here at school is because of my family. I couldn't do anything without my family. Every time I worry or stress about a test, they help me calm down. They tell me, if you study for a test, then there's no point worrying about failing it. Back when I was in elementary school, I was recognized for having the best grades. I received a certificate, and my parents supported me by attending the event in our school library. They told me they were proud of me and gave me big hugs as we celebrated eating muffins together. I love my family with all of my heart. I love the days when my family and I go out to eat because it brings us closer. My sister Monita helps me so much with life, making sure I'm losing weight or telling me to push myself during my workout sets. My sister is the only person that really knows me, knows my style, and knows my favorites. She knows I love coffee, so sometimes she'll go and buy me Dunkin' Donuts, which is one of my favorite coffee places. My favorite memory is me going to the gym with my sister. It's cool and amazing seeing my sister lifting heavy weights, and she's also like my personal trainer. Finally, my parents know everything about me. When I was a kid in elementary school, they helped me with my mental health. At that age, I hated eating when other people were around because I got bullied for being fat. They would often tell me, don't care about what other people think. Eventually, I became more comfortable with eating around others, and now I eat with others and not just by myself. My family has taught me life lessons, and most importantly, how to love myself.
Omar Bauer is an 11th grader at Alhambra High School. He enjoys playing basketball and hanging out with family and friends. To hear more Soapbox essays, go to kjzz.org.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.